DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Father Robert Sirico, who has been active in public policy affairs for more than 30 years. He co-founded the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. He's a sought-after speaker both in America and around the world. Father Sirico's writings on religious, political, economic, and social matters have appeared in various publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Crisis Magazine, and National Review. Father Sirico has also regularly appeared on Fox News, CNN, ABC, the BBC, NPR, and EWTN. With Father Robert Sirico, we go inside the pages of Defending the Free Market, the Moral Case for a Free Economy, published by Reganary. Father Sirico, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a delight, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Defending the Free Market, the Moral Case for a Free Economy. This book is so important. There just isn't a sound articulation from a Catholic social perspective that can really help us, and you really do that in this book.
Try to, you know, not even solely from a Catholic perspective, though it's certainly consistent with that, but I attempted to write it in such a way that it would embrace other faiths, and in fact all people of goodwill who are seeking, you know, an understanding of what ethics mean in the context of economy.
Goes back to basic fundamental truths about how we as humans interact, and that's why it's so universal, isn't it?
Yes, and even more universal than that, not just how we act, but who we are. Mm-hmm. We're made with the reality of a material existence, our physicality, our bodies, and yet there's something more to us than just our physicality, isn't there? I mean, when we love, or when we experience beauty and art or nature, we transcend our physicality, we become more. And I think this is a metaphor, or maybe even just the beginning place, for how we interact in the world of economics, that we bring the physicality and add to it the transcendence, and that produces wealth. We bring out from nature that which didn't exist previously, a new use for a thing like oil that becomes petroleum, it becomes energy, things like that. And it's very important to understand this in anthropological basis if we're going to construct a society that can be called just and fair.
I refer to the Catholic nature of this particular teaching just because it so lifts up the dignity of each person and the gifts that they're given to use to function in society.
Yes, indeed. The Church has really meditated on these kinds of questions for a long, long time, and there's nothing more important to us than understanding that in our neighbor we encounter Christ. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's always been this social dimension to the Church's message, not just worshiping, you know, in a church building, but bringing that out and building societies that approximate the dignity of human beings.
Why do you suppose capitalism has gotten such, can I simplify it by saying, a bad rap?
Well, I think for a variety of reasons. On the part of people who act in the market, we have to remember that the market only reflects the values of people in the market. It's nothing other than the outgrowth of people as they would act in their private, voluntary, peaceful actions. That's what the market is in an economic sense. So that can include materialism and greed and sin and you know all of those kinds of things that everybody points to. But that is not what the essence of the free exchange system is. That's the kind of thing that exists in the human heart. You see it in every system, whether it's socialist or economic. You see it in the Church.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other part of it is that the ideas of, you know, going back even to the 19th century of Karl Marx have and the socialist thinkers have played a very influential role in the way people conceive economics and profit, and indeed in the way they misconceive these things, so that the very word capitalism really has Marxist overtones. definition of economics transcends the finance, money. It really has to do with human action. So I think that's the way to counter it, to not mistake some of the aberrations of people acting in their freedom for the system of economic productivity that we know is capitalism or the free market.
Well, it is so important to come from that perspective that you give us, that human interaction, because human interaction can be influenced by emotion. And if we are acting out of fear, out of a panic, or out of other things that would motivate us to hold back, I mean, that all has elements of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, but also love, right? Mm, there's some economic actions that are loving, and that you know, we go beyond ourselves. So it really is very complex, and this is one of the reasons I say that it is important to keep the state's involvement in that to a minimum. We need a government. Obviously, we need a government to protect the vulnerable, to ensure justice, to adjudicate disputes that occur in a legal sense, to protect the borders, and to protect us from foreign invaders and things like that. Maybe even in disasters, to provide some relief, though sometimes the government's not very good at that as the first responder. But beyond those functions, I think it becomes very problematic if we think of the government as the resource of first resort. When people need things, we make it a political issue rather than a social issue. And I think there's a distinction.
Mm-hmm. You are very clear in that we're talking about free markets. For us to think that in the United States right now that we have a free market system would kind of be a misnomer, because it's not really free, is it?
No, it's heavily mixed and tilting in the direction of more central planning, more and more, especially with the healthcare legislation. Our Social Security system is a good example of that. I understand that retired people need to have secure retirements, but I'm not sure the government is the best way to ensure that.
Mm-hmm.
The healthcare system is a disaster in this country right now. Think about it this way. You and I go to the store and let's say we want to buy something, cereal. Mm-hmm. We look at the brand, we look at the contents, we look at the price, we compare to other similar products on the market. If we don't like what we find there, we go to another grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
When we go to a doctor, do you know how much it is for a doctor's appointment, much
mm-hmm.
less a procedure that he may recommend?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? It's because we're not paying for it. Now, can you imagine what would happen to our market in food if we were not paying for our food, if there was a third payer
mm-hmm.
who was, we would just take whatever we wanted. Oh, a steak every night.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a good thing, but the point is that's what's happened. And what that exemplifies is, and just give me a moment here to explain this, is very important economic concept, but I'll try and make it very simple.
Mm-hmm.
When we buy things in a market, the fact that we bought this particular thing and paid this particular price sends a message. And when people do this across the economic universe, it sends a lot of messages. It sends a lot of data, a lot of information that tells the producers there's a demand for this product, or there isn't a demand for this product, or there's a demand for this product in this shape or this form or this price. And without that information, when we remove that kind of freedom of exchange, the markets become dumb. The intelligence disappears. And that's what's happened in healthcare. And what does that mean practically? It means waste, and it means increased costs, unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happened in the area of healthcare. And I think the move to even take over more of our healthcare by the government really dumbs the whole market down. And I think somebody once said, I think it's P.J. O'Rourke, said, if you think healthcare is expensive now, wait until you see it when it's free.
Father, as a Catholic priest, there is an element to this that maybe in the secular arena they may not be able to articulate very well, but the fact is we don't want to suffer. And to make adjustments sometimes whether or not there is a demand for this particular product or this particular service, and that begins to diminish those who are providing that, they don't want to have to make that adjustment or that change, and which may be called to be necessary, and it may involve some type of suffering. And we want to remedy that and prevent that instead of allowing it to have its conclusion and then allow for the turn that needs to be made.
Right. Well, you know, in economics, that's the case as well. I mean, just from an economic point of view, but that's called trade-offs. From an economic point of view. But of course, no one wants to suffer unnecessarily. The problem is we don't know what's necessary and unnecessary if we don't know the cost of things or the availability of things, or if we crush the creative spirit that can produce new technology or new medicine, again, going back to healthcare. And there are trade-offs that I can't be in both places at the same time. I can't do both things. I can't afford this and that. And so I have to make a choice or a compromise. But who's best to make that determination? It's the person who's making the determination. Even in the Christian sense, we embrace the voluntary detachment from things. That means that we can never have a material thing, or for that matter, even a person, that is more important to us than God. So we detach, utilize things as tools. We never utilize persons as tools, even if they may have a, you know, a useful function. You know, you hire somebody to repair your plumbing because you don't have the expertise to do that. In that sense, they are acting in a utilitarian way. But we always have to regard the human being as sacred. And when you don't have these opportunities in a market, and you don't know what's going on, it's very hard to make any of these moral choices.
Part of our understanding of what is moral or what is ethical can be skewed by our formation. And that is something that you've kind of encountered. You alluded to it at the beginning of the book. I mean, your experience in the 70s.
Oh, yes. I, with a lot of the rest of the world, I went crazy in the 70s. I was involved with all kinds of social change movements that today I certainly would distance myself from. I mean, I'm honest about my involvement having been there, though I try to be discreet for for the telling of it. But no, I was involved, and somebody gave me some books in the middle of all my activism when I came to the point where I was no longer, you know, a firm believer in God, had become a kind of agnostic. Somebody began a conversation with me, and I read some books, and they tripped some levers in my head. These books, by the way, were not on religion. These were not apologetic books. These were just books on economics. And as I began to think about private property in a different way, I had always thought of private property as essentially the right to own a particular object. But I understood it at a deeper level, that they really, what private property is more fundamentally, is the right of a person and their relationship to nature, and what we draw from nature, and the way I described it a little bit ago, the way we take things from natural resources and we use them for human service, that what we produce in that process is called property. And as I thought about that, I thought to myself, what is it about the human person that makes him or her so distinct from all of the rest of creation? And over a period of time, I bumped back into God and back into my faith, because I remembered the things that Sister had taught us when I was a kid in catechism class.
Father, part of the influence of emotion that can take place in that human interaction, what we call the economy, can also be not just fear, but also maybe anger, jealousy, envy, and greed, all those things we call the capital sins.
Yes, you know, especially when we're speaking about economics, we think of greed. And I deal with this in the book. What is greed? Of course, the root of the word simply means desire. But what turns desire into greed? It's the unbalanced nature of Mm-hmm. It's not just people in the market. Politicians are not immaculately conceived. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then when they have the power of government in their hands, and they are also original sinners like the rest of us, it can become very dangerous. That's why we have to believe in limited government.
I think in some cases, there is a sincere desire to help those who do not have what others have. I mean, there's to help the poor. For an economy that is basically springing out of that Christian background, because of the nature of our country, we want to help the poor. But how we do that, that's where it becomes very problematic.
Yeah, and that's a big debate, and it's a legitimate debate in the church. You know, Blessed John the 23rd said that when it comes down to the details, Catholics can have differing opinions. Mm-hmm. The principles we have to agree on, human dignity and life and all of those things. So when it comes down to policy prescriptions, we can have different opinions, and I express my opinion. And because somebody disagrees, you know, that they say we need a bigger state apparatus, and I say we need a smaller one, doesn't mean either of us are heretics. But having said that, let me point out why I think on a prudential level it's important to have limited government and really abide by the principle of subsidiarity. Mm-hmm. This is a very important principle in Catholic social teaching, which tells us essentially that the presumption has to be on the part of the private sector and the most local response to human needs. That the government is not the resource of first resort, it's the resource of last resort. And what that means is, when I look at poverty and the question of poverty, I'm sure a lot of your listeners, good people, immediately thought to themselves as we're talking about poverty, okay, well then that's welfare and that's foreign aid and that's food stamps and that's, you know, all these other things, or charity, you know, giving to people. And Maimonides, who is great Jewish rabbi, and I have the citation from him in the book. Maimonides has, I think, seven levels, seven gradations of charity, higher and higher levels of charity, you know, giving to people from our surplus, giving to people in our need. And then this next to the top level is giving to people anonymously, and the very top level is providing somebody with a job. And somehow in the whole discussion of poverty cure, we have lost sight of the role of business. And yet business is the normal way that people rise out of poverty. It's not charity. Charity is great and important, but it's the emergency. We help somebody charitably when there are no other resources. But if we think we're going to get somebody out of poverty by giving, 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 mm-hmm. it's impossible. The normal way is for people to have access to jobs that, you know, ensure and embrace their dignity. So let's focus there first. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, when there are these circumstances, when there are failures at the local level, how do we respond to those people? And again, we respond best when we respond as neighbors. Mm-hmm. Not when we respond as bureaucrats, not when the poor become a pawn in the political game and people create programs in order to get votes and this whole process. Mm-hmm. How to do this in a way that preserves a sense of the community and a sense of our linked to one another. And that's why I think, and there are a lot of practical ways in which you can attain this through non-governmental means, by enabling the charitable institutions of the church and parishes and private societies and mediating institutions to operate without interference from the government. This is the real threat of this HHS mandate that we've been hearing about a lot, the government imposing on Catholic institutions how we can run our institutions and what services we must and must not provide.
Mm-hmm. It goes back to subsidiarity, doesn't it?
It does. It really does.
And in that, too, it has a sister called solidarity.
Yes. An indispensable sister. And I like the way you put that. It's a sister. They are complementary to each other. They're not two different things. Mm-hmm. And what solidarity is simply put, the recognition of ourself in other human beings. Mm-hmm. experience this relatedness that we have to other human beings, especially in their vulnerability.
Yeah.
Where we drive past somebody on the freeway and we see their car is turned over, and we feel that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the kind of natural mm-hmm. experience of solidarity.
It is incumbent on those business owners, those who are providing services or products to that local community, that local community remain healthy, because
yes.
it helps them to be able to continue to grow. So
exactly.
If you take away the local element, then you're
right.
you're killing it at its roots.
And the smartest businesses know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not this intrinsic hostility between the consumer and the producer, or the worker and the owner of the means of production, or men and women, or man and environment. All of those kinds of contests, the struggles we see, are really, I have to say, I don't mean that everybody is a Marxist, but it really comes out of a Marxist presumption that there is a class struggle mm-hmm. at the root of human society. And I just don't believe that. I believe there's a class harmony that we need each other. Mm-hmm. We need to be reciprocal. Mother Teresa puts it so well. She says we can't condemn the rich. We don't believe in class struggle. We believe in class encounter,
mm-hmm.
where the rich save the poor and the poor save the rich.
Father Sirico, how is it, I mean, from in speaking to a Catholic audience, that the teachings of whether it's Rerum Novarum and all of the popes since then on that Catholic social doctrine has gotten where it really lifts up that subsidiarity, solidarity, common good, universe, and all those things. We don't have an appreciation of that.
No, and I think in years past, I think we had a better appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
But today, so much of these ethical questions have been politicized.
Mm-hmm.
With the growth of the state, with the presumption on the part of certain movements, even within the Catholic Church, I'm thinking of liberation theology,
mm-hmm.
Which you couldn't even criticize years ago. The question moved to the left part of the political spectrum, and I think now it's balancing out. We're able to have a richer, more informed conversation.
What can be done? Is it salvageable? Can our economy once again get back to a smaller state? Can I say that?
Well, I think so. I think it's possible, and the repair will be difficult, especially initially, but I think it's possible because the engines of a market are very powerful if you release people's creativity. The question is how to do that, and a lot of people focus on the political as the solution, and I think the political is only part of the solution, and not even the first part.
Mm-hmm.
The first part, people themselves, citizens, members of parishes, social workers, all the rest, to understand the kinds of things we're talking about. And once that awareness, once that knowledge, that education, that formation, if you will, takes place in a larger portion of society, then the politicians will follow in suit, because politicians are really followers, they're not leaders.
Mm-hmm.
We will elect the people who also believe those things. But again, that's a secondary question. I'm not a member of a political party, so mm-hmm. I don't have a dog in that fight, though what they decide affects me like everybody else. So I think that's the place to begin. But in terms of could we reverse this whole thing, if we went in the right direction, yes. I mean, look, within 15 years, Eastern Europe, for the most part, those nations that most fully embraced free economies in Europe rose out of the colossal wreck of totalitarianism and socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to a place like Poland, or you go to a place like the Czech Republic, or Slovakia. Now, do they have problems? Of course they have problems. But they're arguably doing better than some of the old European countries like Spain and Italy or Greece, who have gone the opposite direction.
Mm. Well, Father Sirico, I have to tell you, in defending the free market, the moral case for a free economy. You have given me enough food, not only in your own writings, but the writings of so many others. I'm going to be reading for the rest of my life, I think.
Oh, good. All those recommendations in the ends of the chapter, is that what you mean?
No, absolutely. Great. They're just phenomenal. I mean, and that in itself is worth so much. We can't remain ignorant. It hurts our children.
It does. And that's one of the most morally egregious things about the debt, our nation's debt, mm-hmm. is that it really is going to put a great burden on people who are not even born yet.
Before we conclude, I have to give a shout out to the phenomenal work you're doing at the Acton Institute, located in my hometown of Grand Rapids, Michigan. How is it going? How is the work of the Institute going?
It's growing by leaps and bounds. We're about 22 years old, and what is remarkable is we grew from one employee. Now we have about 40. Mm. That's not necessarily a sign of good things if it's inflated, but they're hardworking people, and our work is known throughout the world. We are moving into a new building, pray God, if we can get it all renovated, to enable us to expand our presence on the web. Is growing. We have a new documentary that's coming out. People may want to go to povertycure.org and see what's in the works with challenging the notion of trade and replacing it with aid for foreign development. Mm. We have affiliates around the world. So go to the website, acton.org, and you'll see what we do. It's been a privilege these 22 years, both to have a pastoral assignment, because I've always been in pastoral work, but also to work with the Acton Institute.
Any final thoughts?
Well, you know, each of us is made in the image and likeness of God, and He's entrusted us with many talents. And one day we're going to stand before Him, and I just hope that He says to us what He says to those servants in Matthew's Gospel. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You have proven yourself reliable in small things. Now enter into your master's joy.
Mm. Father Robert Sirico, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Chris.
With Father Robert Sirico, we've gone inside the pages of Defending the Free Market, the Moral Case for a Free Economy. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Reganary.com, the website for its publisher, Reganary Publishing, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To learn more about the work of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty, go to acton.org. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.